Imacuc ruled with his friend Anakar at his side, saw the walls of the city built by the gods, many chariots wide the walls, topped in copper strong and glass-faced stone, unbreakable walls to make the city strong, keep its blessings in, its gates open, to send the blessings flowing out into the world.
Just guys being dudes.
Just dudes being guys.
Just guys sinking boats. Welcome, theater goers and riverboat crewmen. I'm Noelle.
And I'm Caitlin.
And this is the Aetolian Archives, your Queen's Thief reread podcast to help you recover from Return of the Thief. It's April 4th, 2021, and today we're discussing Chapter 2 of Thick as Thieves. In this chapter, Kamet takes a walk, goes to the theater, and goes for a boat ride. Oh, and it's all while fleeing for his life.
This is a very visceral chapter. Like, reading it makes me anxious because it's so well written that I can feel his anxiety.
It's stressful.
You know? It's all like his legs are shaking. He could have puked his fear into a bucket. Like,
and you see the limitations of his freedom that he's so proud of. The like limited freedom that he has. He can walk around the city pretty freely, and people don't care. But he cannot leave.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's always like an upper limit to what he can do. But he's really, he's smart in this chapter.
Yeah, he's
freaking out, but
resourceful.
Yeah. The going to the tailor and lying about the new order for robes to get some of his own money.
Yeah, because he knows exactly what will be believed. He knows how to spin it. And he says in this chapter he's very good at hiding his emotions. You know, he walked confidently up the deck of the ship, acting normal. So, he really did pull this off. With some help from a wine merchant.
With some help from a mysterious wine merchant?
Yeah, it says a burly older man in a handsome robe, imposing and obviously wealthy. He was also obviously a former soldier. He still had the bearing and the scars. He was missing his right eye. He hesitated, almost as if he were the one making up a story. And then the sweeping black terror that had flooded my heart a moment before, was receding, leaving me weak in the knees with darkness crowding at the edge of my vision. The merchant almost glowed in contrast, and the noise of the street faded to nothing. Ooh.
Interesting.
I never caught that my first few reads of the book. And then I saw someone, like, talking about it on Tumblr, and I was like, wait a minute, what?
Yeah, it's really easy to miss that little moment, especially because so much is going on before that and so much is going on after that. She does that a lot where she sandwiches something in between two, like, immediately important plot events that's, like, a hint of something later or a little moment.
And it's kind of, like, a little bit disguised by, like, you know, it's an extension of his fear. It's like the sweeping black terror could have caused this, you know, ocular illusion or whatever.
And Kamet and Costas are a good team in this chapter.
Yeah. Although Kamet does not think much of Costas.
No, he does not. He says his sense of superiority was reasserting itself.
Mm-hmm.
It did not seem to me that the King of Aetolia was investing one of his best men in this petty revenge.
Yeah, and it says the Aetolian was, like, scrupulously dividing all the food in half and telling Kamet, like, oh, please sit down. And Kamet narrates, I'm afraid his behavior lowered my opinion of the Aetolian. I had lost everything, I suppose, but my pride. Like a sailor clinging to the wheel of a sinking ship, I wanted to believe I steered the course of my life. And he's used to thinking of himself as better than other people.
Yeah, because that's sort of, like, what he has
in
order to maintain his own dignity.
And, like, at least on the footing of education, you know, one of the first things he says about Costas after he was no veteran, but he was too young to have done his 20 years, my own age, or perhaps younger. He was almost certainly not educated, is one of the first things he says. He's describing
him. And then later when Costas doesn't know who Imacuc and Anakar is, he says he's not surprised because most Aetolians were not educated.
Not just not just, you know, foreign and unfamiliar with foreign myths.
Yeah. And Kamet, like, he is a slave. He can't leave the city on his own. He isn't physically safe. He's not in control of his own body. But he has his mind.
Mm-hmm.
He can be a snob about culture.
Yeah. And learning and knowledge and his own thoughts are something that can't ever be taken away from him.
And Kamet clearly really enjoys telling these stories.
Mm-hmm.
He offers to recite the first tablet for Costas, and he does the whole thing. And of course, it's about two friends who go on a journey together. Great was their love.
The story opens saying, "Greatly wise, cloaked in wisdom, was Imakuk. Greatly strong, clothed in strength, was his true friend Enikar. Great was their love, and greatly did it sustain them in their journeys together."
And we already have a connection between these stories and the real world. When they go to the theater to see the play, it's a story about Annette's chariot, and then the boat that they're on is called Annette's Dream.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fun that they go to the theater. They do it to kill time because they can't be out in the city, but their escape isn't until after dark, and the theater is one of the few places where they could both go and no one would question it.
Yeah.
And they see theater with these stock characters like Commedia dell'arte, and it's this kind of cheap, crappy production, and most of the people aren't even watching it, especially the people who are wealthier, who are in the seats as opposed to being like groundlings. They're just there to have their little secret conversations and do business.
Kamet narrates during the play, "I watched the Aetolian, seemingly enthralled by the play, wishing I had his apparent equanimity." So I think Costas really was just enthralled.
He was, because he asks about it later.
Yeah.
And Costas's mead language skills aren't perfect, and so he couldn't quite follow the entire story. There were some words he didn't understand.
And that's how Kamet excuses his early presence, saying that Costas mistakenly said afternoon instead of after dark because the phrases were similar. And he calls it the first of my many lies.
And he, Costas speaks mead with a heavy accent, which is a problem for them when they're trying to get on the riverboat. So they pretend that he's taken a vow of silence and needs Kamet to speak for him. So they're working together.
Yeah.
Even as Kamet thinks Costas is not his friend, not out to help him, and that he is deceiving Costas.
Mm-hmm. He still thinks Costas is gonna just slit his throat later. He writes in here that you can see from this chapter, Costas clearly has a different view of this whole situation. He narrates, "He told me his name as if he expected me to use it. And what I failed to understand was that in his mind, I was a free man, had been since the moment he met me, and as my host, he wouldn't sit until I did."
It's important to note that we know that this is Costas, but he is not called Costas
mm-hmm.
in this chapter or for a long time afterwards. He's just the Aetolian. And so if you were reading this book first on its own, you would not know anything about this guy. You wouldn't know his name. He's wearing some jewelry. He's wearing an earring, a polished cylinder of stone, which we know is going to be important later, and a ring, I think. And Kamet specifies that that's his only jewelry, which implying that people who are of a higher class wear a lot of jewelry on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. And also kind of on a visual note, Kamet specifies that the chain around his own neck is in a specific double cuff pattern to distinguish it from a free man's jewelry.
Mm.
And that this gold is going to be a problem for them. Do they keep it? Do they not keep it? But they can't get rid of it right now because people will see Kamet in a slave's shift and wonder where he's...
And they can't fence it.
Mm-hmm.
Would be, it's illegal to remove it. And that would be really obvious of them. They're in a pickle there. And yeah. Kamet, he finds that he doesn't feel ready to give it up.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's one of the few things that belongs to him in a perverse sort of way.
Yeah, and he notes that he's surprised that he feels this way. You know, he would have thought that he would have been ready to throw it in the river. Like, he spends part of this chapter after they're, you know, going, when he's going to sleep, he spends the whole chapter thinking about everything he's just lost. He's not, like, ready to give that up.
He's clinging to things that are familiar.
Mm-hmm.
He's going into the great unknown. I love a story about somebody going into the great unknown.
Yeah. And in that same section, he prayed for Layla and said, narrates, "I would light candles on the altar of Shezhmaga, and I would leave honey cakes, I swore, for her to feast on in the afterlife." So I just wanted to point this out. I feel it's significant that we see here that Kamet is genuinely religious and does have a lot of faith in his gods. Especially Shezhmaga, who comes up very often. Who also, that's another connection between real life and Imakuk and Enakar, because in the story, it says that Shezhmaga took pity on lonely Imakuk and turned his path to Enakar.
Right.
Which, where else are we going to see that, huh? Did you make that Return of the Thief connection?
It's interesting that these gods and these legendary heroic figures that are associated with the Mede Empire would intervene to help in a situation that eventually is going to result in their defeat.
Yeah, I had never thought about that before, but that's right.
And we've sort of been associating gods with these, like, artificial state bodies.
Yeah, with the well-being of the nations they're associated with.
Yeah, but what they're really tied to is the land and culture, which seems like a small distinction, but actually it's huge.
Mm-hmm.
And is this an intervention to help the larger narrative that we see along, like the events of the world? Or is it simply in order for Kamet and Costas to have this adventure together and have this relationship with each other?
Yeah. And I think it's interesting to think about, like, those two goals really just intertwine. Just like you can consider with the other gods, did they make those two threads of Irene and Jen meet in the Tapestry of Fate, whatever, for the own, like, personal good of those two or for political good? And I think the answer is kind of both.
Mm.
Something else I noticed about this story, and I guess all of the stories Kamet tells, we have to assume is telling this one story in Aetolian, because he begins it saying, like, oh, there's a translation of the tablet into Aetolian, shall I tell it? And he narrates that it was his own translation. That's kind of Kamet changing the narrative himself also in translation.
Yeah.
Which is very cool. And something else that made me think of is most of the book doesn't really specify which language Kamet and Costas are speaking to each other. Like, we can assume on the streets when they're being overheard by random people, they're speaking Mede, but right here they're speaking Aetolian. Like, one or two other times it's specified when Costas speaks Aetolian, but the rest of the time it's kind of left open. Kamet does say, you know, like, Costas's Mede is improving.
And they get on this boat, and Kamet's trying to figure out a way to escape from Costas at this point, but he can't swim, and he was sort of traumatized by being dragged through the water when he and Nehushtaresh escaped from Aetolia. And then the boat catches fire, and Costas, trying to save his life, throws him overboard, and he panics because he can't swim. And then it turns out that it's actually not that deep, and he can stand up. Which is, that also feels a little bit like maybe you should have faith in fate.
Yeah.
To protect you, Kamet, you know.
Or your friends. Although he doesn't see Costas as a friend yet.
But Costas doesn't seem to have known that it wasn't deep either.
Yeah.
He says, well, you know, because he would have sunk too.
Yeah, because he was wearing armor. And they lose all of Costas' money in the river. And Kamet is thinking to himself, what kind of moron doesn't keep track of his money pouch and just chooses not to think about the obvious answer, a man who had someone else clinging to him like a monkey, trying not to drown. I like that we get this kind of dichotomy between, like, Kamet is purposely showing us this is what he thought then and this is what he thinks now, which is something that I don't know if we get as much of in the other first-person narratives.
Yeah. Kamet is in a lot of ways, he's really self-aware.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a lot of BS, but he knows it.
Yeah. What do you think about... Do you think Kamet is the character who has the most personal growth over the course of his book? What do you think about that? Because, I mean, Sophos has a lot. You know, Jen has a lot over the series. Costas, we don't really see as much, I don't feel. Like, Costas' book really was not about his interiority.
Yeah. Kamet is the character who ends up in the place that's most different from where he started or where he could have predicted.
Yeah. And I feel like he has a correspondingly huge interior journey to deal with that, you know? Like, he's leaving one culture for another. He has to give up all of his former life and a lot of the beliefs and attitudes and ideas that made him safe there. And yeah. Saw him through his previous life.
And the people. I mean, mm-hmm. He cared about people there.
Yeah, he's very obviously grieving in this chapter.
Yeah, he believes that he has left those people to die horribly.
Mm-hmm. Although his running away might get them merely killed instead of tortured to death if people think his running means he's guilty.
Yeah, like in this scenario, there's nothing that he could have done to save them.
But still, he thinks he's... Yeah. And one of the most poignant parts of this chapter is Kamet saying, you know, like all of these things are really weighing on him. Obviously, he's running from death by torture and all of his friends are dead, but he's saying this fear that he's living with right now is really familiar. He knows by long experience how tiring fear is.
Yeah. He's used to being in a state of at least low-level fear all the time.
Yeah. Is this the book with the most myths in it? I've never counted, but I don't know. The Thief has a lot.
The Thief has a lot. This one also has a lot. Also, they're very different. They're formatted very differently.
Yeah, let's talk about the formatting. What do you think it means that these are all in poetry?
I think that it emphasizes that this is literature as opposed to folklore.
Yeah.
Which differentiates it from the Hephaestian myths. And I think it emphasizes that these are different cultures with different storytelling styles.
Yeah. And the language certainly sounds different. It sounds, I don't know the words exactly. Like, it sounds much more formalized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, and it also sometimes sounds like it was difficult to translate into Aetolian.
Mm-hmm. Like, I can't figure out what the meter is exactly, but it sounds metered, you know, like when you read it out loud. Imacuc went into the world and learned about gates closed against him and gates opened, learned about blessings accepted and blessings deserved, wandered lonely until Shesmaga took pity on Imacuc's path, turned it to Enikar, led him to Enikar. It has a lot of repetition in it.
Didn't Megan Whelan Turner say that she wanted to do it in some kind of hexameter and then it was too hard?
Yeah, I was about to bring that up.
Dactylic hexameter, which is, it's the epic poetry like the Iliad. I remember her saying that, but I don't remember where. I think it might have been at the Return of the Thief launch event.
Yeah. And it's cool that the Imcuc and Enikar stories are also travel stories, journey stories, adventure stories.
This is very much, it's a return to the quest narrative, the journey narrative.
Yeah.
Which we haven't had since The Thief.
It's just another nice connection between books.
It's so funny that going into Thick as Thieves, I was like, this would better have Jen in it. Who's this guy? And then going into Return of the Thief, I was like, it better have Cam and Costas.
Yep.
That's chapter two. Next time, we see that pesky wine merchant again.
Send us your comments, questions, thoughts. Chime in at AetolianArchives.tumblr.com.
Be blessed in your endeavors.
Thank you for listening. This has been an Amateur Embroidery production. Find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, anywhere podcasts are available.